Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the 13 Club podcast. My name is Kim.
And I'm Miranda.
And today we have episode number 26 for you.
So exciting. That's 13 times 2.
Oh, so didn't think about that. And also, we have broken 5,000 listens.
Oh my god, you guys. Thank you so much. We're really, really, in all, like, earnestness, we're all, like, we're very pumped and excited to have 5,000 listens across all of our episodes. Thank you guys so much. Whether this is, like, your first time listening to an episode or if you've listened to all of them, like, thank you so much for being here.
I think this is just one milestone and we're just going to keep on going. But I know we've tried a lot harder this year to put out consistent content, and I think it is paying off because we're reaching a lot more of you and we're making a lot more friends doing this, and I'm really excited to see how it continues on.
Yeah, and we hope that you feel like it's paying off as well. We hope that you like can tell that our hearts are really in this and that we're here for you. It's almost as if we're establishing some kind of a club.
Yeah.
With members.
We've got a lot of new club members.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. So, what do you have for us today?
All right. I was just saying this to Kim just before we started recording, but, you know, sometimes it's really hard for me to let go with a topic and to know, like, when I've done enough. So, I hope this one really tickles you guys' fancy. Today I'm going to talk about the occult life and death of Netta Fornario.
Ooh.
And I'm going to, like, start up front by telling you there's some, like, place names in this that are, I believe, Scottish Gaelic. And boy, I don't know how to pronounce that. I even tried to look up some of these pronunciations, and, like, short of getting into, like, YouTube videos where people teach you Scottish Gaelic, I couldn't do it, so you'll have to forgive me. So
it's allowed. We can only try our best.
Exactly. If you know how to pronounce any of these, please feel free to leave us a comment and help me out, and I will
educate us.
I will correct myself if you can teach me how to do this right. So what we know of Netta's upbringing in early life is pretty scant. She was half English and half Italian. We know that she was born in Cairo in or around 1897, and her mother, Nora, died 1 year later. Netta's father was Giuseppe Fornario. He was an Italian professor and a director of Milan's Medical Institute. After his wife died, he handed Netta's care over to her English grandparents, so her maternal grandparents. I don't know if he was, like, overwhelmed with work and couldn't take care of a child, but he basically kind of gave her up at that point. And Netta, also known as Nettie or Nora, spent much of her early life living with her grandparents in the affluent London suburb of Kew in the early 1900s. From a young age, she showed a keen interest in the rising field of spiritualism and was really intrigued by the possibility of communicating with the dead. To give a brief, quick and dirty explanation, spiritualism is a religious movement based on the belief that the spirits of the dead exist and have both the ability and the inclination to communicate with the living. To spiritualists, the afterlife or the spirit world is not a static place, but one where spirits continue to evolve and are more advanced than the living. And both of those beliefs lead to the third sort of core tenet of the movement, which is that spirits are capable of providing useful knowledge about moral and ethical issues, as well as the nature of God. Spiritualism was at its most popular from the 1840s when it first appeared through the 1920s, and was characterized by the rise of mediums. So, mediums being people who have claimed to have the ability to contact the dead. Probably the most well-known example of spiritualist mediums are the Fox sisters, but we might someday do an episode about them or even just talk more about the spiritualism itself. So I'm not going to get too into it here. I just want to make sure you guys have the background and the context necessary to kind of know what Netta was all about. As she got older, Netta's relationship with her father must have, like, mended, and they must have had, like, at least an okay relationship, because The pair would occasionally go on holiday together. One peculiar story that I found was that on a trip to Egypt, Giuseppe bought a statue of Osiris for his daughter. But this was actually a huge mistake because it caused them to have a huge argument because Netta was convinced that the statue was cursed. Fornario, who considered himself like a man of science and a rationalist, told his daughter that she was being ridiculous, but the damage was done and she never spoke to him again.
Wow.
Again, ever.
Wow.
Netta's interest with the occult continued to grow as she got older, and she eventually pursued these interests far enough so as to become a member of the Alpha et Omega offshoot of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which some of you guys may have at least heard of, even if you don't really know what it is. The Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, or just the Golden Dawn, was a secret society that was devoted to the practice of the occult, metaphysics, and paranormal activities in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It's probably one of the largest single influences on 20th century Western occultism, and most people associate it with member Aleister Crowley, who was the noted writer, occultist, and magician.
The most evil man in the world, yes. Aleister Crowley.
The order eventually became bogged down by, like, a series of scandals, some of them being, like, sex cult type stuff, which is obviously not the spirit in which the organization was founded. And specifically, the difference between the Alpha and Omega and the original Golden Dawn Order stems from this sort of, like, the internal politics between the founders and these scandals eventually basically just causing a huge schism within the organization. And the Alpha and Omega members were loyal to one of the three original founders, Samuel Mathers. But that's really the biggest difference. They practiced the same things and believed most of the same things. It's just who you believe heads your organization and best represents what they're all about, I guess.
Right.
Or at least as I understood it. So in 1929, Netta Fornario, who was, depending on when you believe she was born, in her late 20s or early 30s, left London for Iona, which is a small island in Scotland with a long and interesting history. Iona Island is quite small. It's about 2 kilometers or 1 mile wide and 6 kilometers or 4 miles long, with a population of about 125 people. I saw some varying estimates for how many people live on Iona Island. I think maybe now it's closer to 175, but still, not a lot of people live there. It's believed that the Isle of Iona was landed upon by Columba, also known as Saint Columba, who was an Irish abbot and missionary who was credited with spreading Christianity in Scotland in the 5th century. So, you know, something like 1500 years ago? Besides being credited with the typical saintly abilities of prophesying, having healing abilities, and being able to repel dragons, he founded Iona Abbey, which existed for about 400 years, surviving multiple Viking attacks and massacres, before finally in 825, the remaining monks were martyred in a Viking raid and the abbey was burned to the ground. The abbey still somehow wasn't totally deserted at this point, but its importance was greatly diminished, and most of the monks from Iona moved to the continent to establish monasteries elsewhere. Sometime later, Benedictine monks established a new monastery and an Augustinian nunnery on the foundations of the original abbey. But the Scottish Reformation happened, and all of the abbeys, not just in Iona, but throughout the rest of the British Isles, were basically dismantled and abandoned. But Iona's mystical vibe doesn't begin and end with monks and nuns. It's said that Dun I, the highest point on Iona, is home to a well of eternal youth associated with St. Bridget of Ireland. Ancient Celtic myth speaks of Bridget visiting Iona at midnight on the summer solstice, where she blesses the waters of the little pool there to carry healing for those who seek renewal. There's also a very large, important fairy hill, or Sathane Moor, This grassy knoll was historically the setting for many rituals and traditions rooted in both pagan and Christian beliefs, and according to many local folklorists, it is, perhaps obviously, associated with a world of the supernatural. A poet contemporary to us now, poet John Philip Newell wrote, "It is an ancient practice to pray at the rising and setting of the sun, those times of confluence when the day meets the night and the light gives way to the darkness. Saint Columba liked to pray on this hill as the great fire of the sun dipped into the Atlantic. On one occasion, a young brother in the monastic community secretly followed the abbot at sunset to see what it was Columba did in his evening practice of prayer. The young monk, perched on a hillock at the edge of the Glen of the Fairies, saw that as Columba prayed, there were angels of light descending and ascending on him. Thus it came to be called the Hill of the Angels. In the Celtic world, these messengers of light are everywhere present. The glory is at times more readily seen on Iona, but it shines too in the darkest places of our lives and world." Fairies also are just hugely important in Scottish folklore, as well as in other European countries. They're not all the Tinkerbell you might picture from childhood. Rather, fairies in folklore are protectors of nature and life, from every loch and forest to being able to make your crops fail if you anger them, or even steal children.
Yeah, do not fuck with fairies.
You gotta have respect for fairies. Not all even take humanoid appearance, with some appearing bird-like or fish-like. Fairies kind of just a broad term in folklore that applies to other creatures like selkies and brownies and pixies and gnomes and others. So fairies are pretty important here. It was at one time believed that the soil in which a person was buried was believed to have magical properties. Specifically, if you're burying a body next to an important figure, like a saint. So with the number of saints and monks that were killed on Iona over hundreds of years, it's only natural that people thought that the soil there was super saturated in sanctity that was believed to dissolve sin. So a lot of super old school royals were buried on Iona, and it's believed that the real life King Macbeth, not the Shakespeare one, but the one that he was based on, is supposed to be buried there. There's also a really interesting legend I found that one of the chapels built on the island, St. Oran's Chapel, they believed it could only be completed through human sacrifice. St. Oran apparently volunteered to be buried alive, but he was found to have survived when the grave was opened a few days later. Allegedly, he claimed that he'd seen hell and it wasn't all bad, which only enraged his fellow religious folks with his blasphemous statements, and they straight up reinterred him. So I guess he still ended up dying for the church, although I don't know, it's the human sacrifice he initially signed up for. A legendary English diarist of the time, contemporary to Netta here, the English diarist Dr. Samuel Johnson described his visit to the island and wrote of the strange, magnetic, yet seemingly inanimate and abstract, highly powerful energy that could be felt on the island and the effect that it had on him. There's a lot more I could get into with this island, but I think I've painted you a picture of how it has this, like, deeply, like, ancient, historic significance, and that over a long period of time, it's, if you are the kind of person to believe in that kind of thing, there's a great energy attached to it for a lot of reasons, both from, like, kind of a Christian perspective and, like, a pagan perspective. There's vibes, big vibes, basically. We don't...
Makes me want to go there.
I know, I really want to go, honestly. It's such a small island, I feel like I could just spend a week exploring every inch of it, you know? I really want to, but we don't know why Netta decided to go to Iona. I don't think she ever actually specified, but it seems like exactly the kind of place that a burgeoning young mage might choose to visit for various reasons, whether they're mystical or strictly historical. And by all accounts, it seems that she was prepared to stay there for quite a while. There are a lot of accounts that say that she showed up with tons of luggage for an extended stay. She began lodging with one Mrs. McRae, with whom it said that she struck up a friendship. Maybe that is an unlikely friendship, given that, as far as we know, Mrs. McRae was a pretty normal person, and Netta was very... eccentric, I guess, for her time. I guess she's pretty eccentric for our time, too. Netta was known to take long walks around the small island and expressed interest in a lot of the more historically significant places on the island, especially the ones that are tied into religious and occult things. She was also reported to go into trances. It's said that Netta believed she'd been given the gift of healing and fasted to the point of illness so she could enter a trance-like state and be at one with nature and the universe. She advised her host that if she was ever to be discovered in such a trance, under no circumstances was the doctor to be called. She was trying to channel the Green Ray Elementals, which are the fairies or spirits that reside on the island. This kind of lifestyle went on for several weeks without any real event, but as summer started to turn into fall, something pretty suddenly seemed to change. One day, Netta sent a strange message to her housekeeper back in London, stating that she would be out of communication for a while because she had, quote, a terrible case of healing to work on.
Same.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
I mean, that healing spring sounds pretty good to me right about now, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
On November 17th, McCrae awoke to find Netta in a frenzy of packing her luggage. Netta informed her that she needed to return to London immediately, as several individuals were attacking her telepathically. She spoke of a rudderless ship that crossed the sky and strange visions. McCrae didn't notice anything physically wrong with Netta, besides her clear distress, although she did notice that Netta's shiny silver jewelry had tarnished completely overnight. McRae informed Netta that at this time, travel was impossible, being that they were on this teeny tiny little island, the only way on or off was via a boat, and the boat to the mainland didn't run on Sundays. Netta is said to have become extremely distressed and retreated to her room in what multiple sources I looked at kept referring to as a rage. However, several hours later, she came back out and calmly announced that she'd changed her mind and was going to stay on, and then left to go on one of her routine walks. So it seemed like she had calmed down and everything was fine. However, later in that afternoon arrived and Netta had not come back, and Mrs. McRae started to get concerned. And eventually she alerted whatever authority exists on a tiny island of 100-something people in 1917, and they started an island-wide sweep for Netta. It took 2 days for them to find her body, which is pretty strange considering how small that island is. And especially weird when you realize that her body was discovered only 2.5 miles away from the cottage she was staying at. It was near the remains of an ancient village, the remains of an ancient village, that Vernario had expressed interest in visiting. I tried to see if I could figure out what ancient village this might have been, and I found information about one called the Hill of the Fort, which is the oldest known habitation from the Iron Age. So, like, truly, truly ancient. Supposedly, this area is also really near that fairy hill that I mentioned before. Cut into the ground underneath her body was like a big cross. There was a dagger found on the ground nearby and another one in her hand. I saw different accounts that said different things, but she was either completely nude with a black cloak folded next to her, or the black cloak was the only thing that she was wearing when her body was discovered. There were mysterious scratches all over her body, and as well as on the bottom of her feet. I saw one specific source that said she only had scratches on her toes, which is something I'll come back to. Regardless, here she is, laying in between two powerful locations on this spiritually charged island, with her body laying on top of a giant cross and surrounded by daggers. Doctors examined her body and could not establish a date or time of death, so she could have died any time between when she was last seen on the 17th and on the 19th when her body was discovered. And they also were, like, similarly wishy-washy about saying what her cause of death was. It was either exposure to the elements or heart failure. Or heart failure due to exposure to the elements.
Okay.
Some residents of the island came forward claiming to have seen strange blue lights on the island, some dating as far back as Netta's arrival. Others claimed to have seen a cloaked figure out walking with Netta, but they were never able to identify the mysterious stranger. Netta's private letters and diary were passed on to the police, who were so troubled by what they read there, they passed those letters on up the chain to Procurator Fiscal's office, where today their whereabouts are unknown. I don't know if they were lost or if maybe they were destroyed, but whatever she wrote in her diary and whatever was in her personal correspondence seemed to have really upset some people. The weather on the night she disappeared was known to be cold and windy, and after all, it was November on a small island off the coast of Scotland. I looked up what the, like, average climate in Iona in November is, and the high is averaged at 37 degrees Fahrenheit with a low of 29 degrees, which is pretty cold to be out in just a thin black robe.
Right.
We do not know what happened to her shoes or her other clothes, and of course we do not know what caused her to panic as severely as she did in the hours before she disappeared. To some people, this is a case of a young woman who was ignorant of the weather, who got lost and confused on a dark night out alone, and she shouldn't have been out there anyway because you shouldn't mess with spirits and you shouldn't mess with the occult. Or you just think the occult and this kind of stuff is stupid and you don't buy into it.
Okay.
But this could also be, however, according to some of her fellow practitioners of the magical arts, the deadly result of a psychic attack by someone many miles away. So, Netta was good friends with someone named Dion Fortune, or Dion Fortuna. I'm not sure if that's their real name. But they were the author of Psychic Self-Defense, a book called Psychic Self-Defense, and they were also a member of the Alpha et Omega Society. And they seem to believe that this could totally have been the result of supernatural force. Quote, I knew Miss Fenario intimately. She was especially interested in green ray elemental contacts, too much interested in them for my peace of mind, and I became nervous and refused to contact with her. It appeared to me that Mac, as we called her, was going into very deep waters. Even I knew her, and that she was certain to come to trouble sooner or later. She had evidently been on an astral expedition from which she never returned. She was not a good subject for such expeditions. Fortune also claimed to have seen others with the same strange scratches that were discovered on Netta's body. Fortune believed that they were caused by psychic attacks from the former leader of the Alpha et Omega Temple, when Moina Mathers, who was the wife of the Mathers I mentioned several minutes ago. The caveat to that is Moina Mathers had been dead for 18 months at this point, meaning if she was the source of Netta's torment and perhaps others, it could only have come from beyond the grave. However, Moina's possible motives were never elaborated on.
Damn, what's the beef? Tell me the tea.
I gotta know, and especially since it's clear that this organization had been undergoing lots of upheaval for the last several years, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me that there might have been beef. But I gotta know.
Right.
One inconsistent detail that serves as evidence for those who believe that something paranormal was going on with Netta's death is that of the accounts that say that the scratches were only on her toes. Because the issue for them is, how does a woman walking barefoot for over a mile onto jagged rocks end up with only scratches on her toes? If you believe that she only had scratches on her toes, the theory is that she was levitated to where her body was found. Or,
okay,
hey, you know, on perhaps a less supernatural note, her body could have just been placed there. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if she wasn't the one to have carved the cross in the ground, maybe as part of, like, a ritual or something, maybe her body was placed there by whoever killed her.
I know, I was like, sounds like a murder to me.
I know. And even if she did not carve that cross herself, again, since obviously she was really involved in the occult community, and it's possible that her murderer could have also been involved in the occult community. Maybe they're the one that drew the dagger there and placed her body there in a ritualistic manner. We don't know. Netta's body was eventually laid to rest on November 21st, with nothing but a simple headstone to mark her grave. Netta was obsessed by the writings of William Sharp under his pseudonym Fiona MacLeod. He was a Scottish poet and novelist. At one point, Nettie had gone to see a London opera titled The Immortal Hour, based on MacLeod's writing more than 20 times, and she wrote a subsequent review of the production for the Occult Review Journal. The opera was a tale of fairy folk and magic, in which the fae are cast as a breed of strong immortals that humans are in fear yet awe of, because of their ability to interfere with, manipulate, and control people. But as we can see from looking back at her life, Nettie had an unwavering fascination with the fae. She writes of, quote, students of mysticism who are able to understand the great truths behind the gossamer curtain of the fae. However, she also makes mention of the appearance of the demonic in the opera, symbolizing dark atavism, and crucially, she points out the reaction of these lower principles to the stimulus of superconsciousness often produces disastrous results. In other words, demonic forces may react strongly to anyone opening up their consciousness to hidden realms, and implying here that she did seem well aware of the dangers of dabbling in the unseen world and the possibility of being confronted with the malign forces that dwelt in it. However, it seems this failed to stop her in her quest. Continuing in her review, she quotes the lines of a character from the original version of the work, "There is no dream save the dream of death." And she interprets this as making explicit that death itself is only a dream. The ultimate reality lies in the other world where all of life is one. She remonstrates that these lines should not have been left out of the opera, and clearly this is a crucial clue as to where she herself may have wished to go, to where she believes is life beyond death, where a life continues after bodily death. Whether Netta was a victim of demonic forces, or the fae, or a more human foe, I hope for Netta's sake that she's somewhere where there's life beyond death. My final note on this case is that Netta's skeptical father, Giuseppe Fenario, claims that on 17th of November 1929, the day that his daughter disappeared, he was overcome by a strong, unshakable feeling of foreboding and doom. He was struck by the feeling that something was wrong with his estranged daughter, but he couldn't rationalize it and he couldn't understand it. Later, when he learned of Netta's death, he could only give in to the unexplainable, attributing the feeling to a premonition or perhaps an act of telepathy. Maybe his own daughter was letting him know something was wrong in her final moments, or maybe she was even already across the veil at that point. He never forgave himself, and we don't know whatever happened to him after that.
That's a bummer.
So that is my...
I feel really sorry for Dad.
I know. That's my story on the life and death of Netta Fornario.
That's interesting.
We don't have a lot of answers, but I'm just really intrigued by the all of it.
Yeah, it's a really cool mystery. It makes me really want to go there, to the island.
Yeah, I agree.
Maybe sometime when I go to Ireland next, I can make a stop off.
Pop over into Scotland. Iona Island.
Pretty easy to pop over, but I don't know if the island is the island open. Can you visit there? You know, these are questions.
I think it is. I think they've got like, I've got some of my information from their like islands tourism website, but it is tiny for sure. So,
I want to visit someday.
I think they've been working on restoring some of those old buildings, and I think I did obviously didn't include it because there was not really any reason to. But the convent's graveyard is still mostly intact. Oh. And so you can like visit all these like really fucking old nun graves, which is pretty cool.
I like me an old nun grave.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for sharing that with us. I liked that one. I like, I'm very familiar with a lot of like older Order of a Golden Dawn stuff, of the Golden Dawn, rather.
Mm-hmm.
Of one Golden Dawn.
Just the one.
Just one. Yeah, and hermetics and stuff are pretty neat. It's just something I've studied in my own personal occult practices. But yeah, there's a lot of, like, weird stuff that goes on in that section of occultism.
I feel like I wanted to know her. I wish I could have known her.
Yeah. She seemed rad.
Mm-hmm.
So today, I am talking about one of my favorite music artists. But I have a reason to do so. So, I am talking about an article that was posted on Stereo Gum back on September 21st, 2018. Apparently it's 2018 day for me because my postmortem topic was also that. And it was written by Michael Nelson, and it's called The Crying of Lot 55, The Unsolved Mysteries and Alternate Realities of Andrew W.K.
All right.
So, I'm a huge Andrew W.K. fan, and he recently won an award from, like, a suicide prevention organization because his last album was called You're Not Alone, and it was all about, basically, like, finding healing and community and being in this together and not being alone and not hurting alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that about him, but then I think he's, like, blossomed into, like, this awesome, like, motivational speaker person, but there was some really weird things that happened earlier in his career that made him extra interesting, and today I want to talk about those.
Alrighty.
So I'm going to read this article. There will be, like, interjections of things that I know about him, because I have followed his career for a really long time, but also I've watched a lot of little films that people have made. I've watched a lot of interviews with him, just to kind of figure this stuff out. And the thing is that no one really has an answer to this mystery.
All right.
Let's start now, or as close to now as can be defined in this conversation. Between the time and place I am in as I write these words and the time and place that you are in as you read them. On my end now is roughly 2 weeks after the release of Andrew W.K.'s video for the title track of his 2018 LP, You're Not Alone. It's an odd clip. A negative image video allegedly meant to illustrate the following bit of Andrew W.K.'s worldview. By inverting every polarity and reflecting every opposite, we can unite the highest and lowest parts of ourselves and rejoice in the ever-contrasting intensity of being alive. It's odd, though, because at points the figure on the screen looks nothing like Andrew W.K. This, of course, is the result of the filming technique, but it brings to mind a question I've been meaning to ask. What does Andrew W.K. look like? Mm-hmm. Do you know what Andrew W.K. looks like? I have shaken the man's hand. I've looked him square in the eye. I've watched him on stage and seen him in literally hundreds and quite possibly thousands of pictures and videos. If I had to describe Andrew W.K. to a police sketch artist, I could probably do a pretty good job. My own sketching abilities, though, are a bit rusty. The Andrew W.K. story is like nothing else in music, maybe nothing else in the world, and there is no story I'd rather tell. I can't, of course. I would, though. In a heartbeat. I would spill everything and spare nothing. I can't, not because I'd betray any confidences or violate any agreements or put myself in harm's way, but because I don't know the Andrew W.K. story. I don't know enough of it, at least. I don't know what's true and what's not true. I don't think anybody knows the whole truth of the Andrew W.K. story. I honestly don't think Andrew W.K. knows anymore. I'm absolutely certain that he wouldn't tell you even if he could, but I think he would get lost if he were to try. I think there are so many long-abandoned dead ends and red herrings and random acts of misdirection, so many layers of illusion interspersed with so many other layers of reality, that I can't believe that he can keep it straight. I doubt he completely remembers the whole bunch of it, and there are a lot of details about which he surely knows nothing. Maybe he does, though, right? He might. Who knows? For the purposes of this conversation, let's tell ourselves that there is nobody who knows the whole truth of the Andrew W.K. story. And let me tell you, I'm not pretending to know more or less than what it is I'm telling you today. I'm sure somebody knows more than I do, but they are not here. I am. And let me tell you this, too. I've been doggedly following the whole mess for longer than I can even believe, and I've done my level best to keep close track of the plot to the extent such a thing is possible. So before I forget anything, I'm going to tell you some of the story as I remember it, i.e. as much of the story as I know. Sounds good. Good. Let's begin with what we know. Andrew W.K. was born Andrew Wilkes Cryer. That much is generally accepted as a fact without dispute. Personally, I think it's the first act of misdirection. As I see it, this is where the maze starts. It's a fascinating little anecdote, frankly, although you don't hear it told much anymore. According to an old bio, Andrew was named after a drunk driver turned drugstore cowboy turned murderer named Andrew Stevenson, who started calling himself Andrew White and was given the alias The White Killer by the Michigan police force tracking him down. Here's an actual line from the actual bio. Andrew's father was fond of the name, and as chief officer on the police force, he named his son after the killer once they caught him and executed him in 1987. Does that sound like a true story to you? Police chief names his son after dirtbag drifter who's just been executed after being convicted of 3 murders? Let's say it sounds not even plausible, but within the realm of earthly possibility? And then let's wipe that off the board by pointing out that Andrew W.K. was born in 1979. This is a fact, unless you see some reason to doubt the unredacted information included right here on the man's own Florida State ID card, which was randomly shared on the man's own Instagram on one random day in 2014. Doubt, I suppose, is the order of the day, but I beg of you, don't get bogged down in this. The man's precise date of birth is beyond the point. He was obviously not born in 1987 and was not 13 years old when that bio was written. Moving on. Regarding the WK, these are the very next lines from that same self-bio. Andrew WK, white killer, woman cum, wild kid, want kicks. It's all the fucking same. He fucking kills the music to make you dance. So by sheer dint of luck, the boy's hyphenate surname, Wilkes Cryer, has the same initials as the namesake's weird alias, White Killer, which could also stand for a women come, wild kid, or want kicks, right?
I think I've heard...
it's all the fucking same.
I think I've heard wild kid, but I've never heard those other ones.
Yeah. This is a lie, but history is made up of lies. There are no reliable narrators, no omniscient observers, no chroniclers capable of capturing the complete scope of events. This is the essential emptiness of every story, if not the sole absolute truth found in any story. This is the Andrew W.K. story. Let's go back to the start of the maze. Andrew W.K. was born Andrew Wilkes Cryer. There is corroborating evidence to prove this, so we can comfortably accept this as being true. The following is also true. Andrew Wilkes Cryer grew up in Michigan. He studied classical piano, listened to death metal, and played in a handful of experimental noise bands. Eventually, he moved to New York City, where he made some valuable connections. Matt Sweeney from Chavez, Donald Tardy from Obituary, Dave Grohl, and started making music as Andrew W.K. He self-financed and recorded a couple of EPs, around the turn of the millennium, which were released via Michigan-based avant-garde indie label Bulb Records. On those EPs, in retrospect, we hear a nascent iteration of Andrew W.K.'s signature sound, but we recognize immediately the artist's vision. So too, in the moments, dig a handful of raving tastemaker types, and eventually Island Records, who courted and signed Andrew W.K. and gave him the resources to make a proper album. That album is called I Get Wet. We're getting ahead of ourselves, though. The questions, the very first questions, predate the album's release. They also predate the very weirdest and weirdness, although perhaps it is accurate to say they presage the very weirdest weirdness. It's so hard to read all that. Even before the world at large had heard the name Andrew W.K., there were questions. Who is Andrew W.K.? Is Andrew W.K. real? Who is the real Andrew W.K.? At the time, these questions took a fairly artless, inelegant form. Incidentally, I don't remember this at all, and if I hadn't found evidence of it, I wouldn't even bother to include it here, but evidence exists. In an October 24th, 2001 review of WK's first ever British show at the Garage in London, The Guardian's Alex Petridis included this truly random note. One music biz conspiracy theory currently circulating suggests that Andrew W.K. was an elaborate hoax devised by former Nirvana drummer Dave Grohl. I find this utterly preposterous. Not even the suggestion that Dave Grohl somehow invented or devised Andrew W.K. This is verifiably false, but the idea that the caterer of actual music biz types would perpetuate such an obvious, ludicrous, easily disproven rumor. And I am legitimately dumbfounded by the fact that it was mentioned in The Guardian, one of the most widely read publications on the planet, a newspaper that has existed since 1821 and has won dozens of major awards, including the Pulitzer for investigative journalism. But it wasn't just The Guardian. The very same morsel was included in another early review. This one was published by none other than the BBC. The rumor is that Andrew W.K. is a none too elaborate joke foisted upon the world by ex-Nirvana drummer Foo Fighter Dave Grohl. Gossip hounds reckon that Grohl penned the W.K. anthems for a laugh and got Andrew, the long-haired sex god, to front them. It's not a coincidence that most of the above-quoted publications are based in England. Like most new American rock acts around the turn of the millennium, Andrew W.K. was initially promoted to British audiences as a way of building up buzz for the eventual stateside push. I Get Wet came out in Europe on November 13, 2001, but wasn't released in America till March 26, 2002. A week prior to W.K.'s October 2001 garage gig, not his UK debut, but his fourth or fifth show ever under the Andrew W.K. moniker, and his very first period with a backing band, he was featured on the cover of NME, touted as, yes, the savior of music. To be fair, W.K.'s seemingly out-of-nowhere arrival might have prompted some media folks to assign credence to the Grohl rumor, especially when taking into account the broader environment. The U.K., circa late 2001, a climate in which dumb hoaxes were made brisk for business. Consider, for instance, two other NME features that ran about roughly the same time as the cover story. Finally, the truth about the White Stripes. We investigated the endless wedding sibling rumors, and we finally revealed the identity of Randy Fitzsimmons, the Svengali and so-called sixth member of the Hives. Given that context, I can understand why mainstream Brit journalists felt compelled to mention the Grohl theory in their own initial coverage of Andrew W.K., but where did it come from? I know enough about the standards and practices of news organizations like The Guardian and BBC to know that they don't blindly bring attention to spurious, unsourced gossip, especially if the express purpose of including such information is to give the impression of being hip to the real story. My point is that somebody has to start a rumor, and somebody had to share that rumor with professional journalists at The Guardian and at BBC, and that person has to be credible enough for journalists to feel comfortable publishing that rumor, and that rumor is fucking ridiculous, so that person must have been really goddamn credible. Who started the rumor? Who spread it? Those are the real questions, but you'll never get any answers. This wasn't even the beginning. This was before the beginning. This is ancient history. Stuff that occurred on a different continent in a different world. Who knows? By the time I Get Wet landed in America, the Grohl business had been erased from Andrew W.K.'s narrative. Yet somehow, the updated narrative was also wrong, perhaps equally demonstrably wrong, and the media were still treating it as reliable. During I Get Wet's promotional cycle, W.K. claimed his album's title was a reference to feeling excitement, particularly the feeling of excitement as experienced by the human body, sweat pouring, tears flowing, saliva dripping, pulse racing, endorphins pumping. The explanation was largely taken at face value and seemed square with the album's core lyrical theme, partying. I Get Wet's lead single, and Andrew W.K.'s best-known song to this day, was called Party Hard, and it was part of a track list with similarly sounding fun titles like It's Time to Party and Party Till You Puke. Almost instantly, W.K. was known in popular culture as the party guy, a goofy, goony brand, but one embraced and embodied by W.K. in the months after the release of I Get Wet, one he continues to flog openly and perhaps excessively even today. The lyrics on I Get Wet, though, did not support this reading. The party described by Andrew W.K. did not sound fun. It sounded like The Purge. There are some lyrics on I Get Wet that need a trigger warning, some lyrics that make me uncomfortable and I cannot type them out, some lyrics that sound like they're written in code. But here is an example that's pretty straightforward, relatively unobjectionable, and representative of the whole from Ready to Die. This is your time to pay. This is your judgment day. We made a sacrifice, and now we get to take your life. What the fuck kind of party is that? In that light, how the hell were people buying WK's newspeak interpretation of the title I Get Wet? He was obviously retconning or gaslighting, especially considering the alternative connotations. There was, for example, the phrase's sexual suggestiveness. There was the fact that Get Wet is an old-school dirtbag bag slang for smoke dust, used frequently when you trick another kid into smoking dust, which is pretty much the worst prank you can pull on another human being. Dust is not a party drug. It's a chemical that allows you to experience your worst nightmares in the physical world. Most overtly, there was the album's cover featuring WK caked in his own blood, looking not excited, but anesthetized, sedated, sated, like a jungle predator who had just finished feeding. So why in the world did anyone think of Andrew WK as the party guy? It would be like thinking Michael Haneke, the guy who makes funny movies about playing games, the funny game movie guy, the funny game guy.
I don't know anything about that movie.
Oh, really?
Really.
It's a big deal. As I write this, actually, it occurs to me that there could be more to that analogy than a shared sense of horrifying irony. Haneke's original German language version of Funny Games was released in 1997, a couple years before the official arrival of Andrew WK, and it wouldn't surprise me to learn that the film had served as a mood board for WK's aesthetic, if not the music's lyrical content. In any case, whether by coincidence or design, the two things share numerous notable similarities, a piece of one another, and it really does look like it. There's a comparison. It's like the title card of Funny Games, and it's just a red text over a person's face, mm-hmm. and then his party hard, which is like it looks the same. Then of course there is the blood, and almost famously in both cases there are the all white costumes, against which blood stands out in a sharp, horrifying contrast. Andrew WK always wears all white, and in the movie they also wore all white because they were pretending to be attendants on the golf course, but they were actually like brutal murderers. It's a really hardcore movie. It's got some like intense gore and intense murder scenes, and it was pretty infamous for that. Do you see it? Am I losing my mind? Don't answer that. It's irrelevant. Let me say this. Hear me out. Whether you're intimately familiar with I Get Wet, sort of recall its presence on the periphery of your consciousness, or have never heard of the damn thing, I ask you to trust me now, wipe your mind clean, and read the following without prejudice. I Get Wet is a wild experience. It's a genuine oddity, a weird burst of unhinged id, and it seems to exist in its own self-contained universe, only fleetingly visible in this one. It doesn't have influences so much as ingredients, bizarre ingredients melted out in bizarre proportions. ABBA, Motorhead, Ministry, Meatloaf, Donkey Kong, dirt bikes, snuff films, WrestleMania. If you contend with the album's substance rather than allow yourself to be fooled by its Rashomon effect, I Get Wet has the feel of an X-Men origin story, a military-funded black ops experiment in biochemical engineering whose formula proves too potent. But before its creators can make the necessary adjustments, it gets loose, and it's an unpredictable, uncontrollable superweapon capable of leveling cities. It can be contained, but doing so requires the public to be distracted via some combination of mass hypnosis and subtly enhanced drinking water fluoride and relentless, focused spin. I Get Wet received near universal acclaim upon its North American release, but all the reviews, positive and negative, seem to be recycling a PR bullet rather than engaging in the music substance. For example, this line from the AV Club's review, written by Stephen Thompson. On his endearing ode to his one-time home of New York City, quote, I love NYC, WK's chorus sums up its charms in 10 words. I love New York City. Oh yeah, New York City. Now those are indeed the lyrics of the chorus of I Love NYC, but those are not the only lyrics. And if you know the other lyrics, you know that the song is not an endearing ode to anything. In fact, once you get past the chorus, which sounds weirdly cruel and sarcastic and disembodied in context, everything else in the song is horrifying and confusing and cryptic. Here's an example of what I mean. Run them over. Run them out. Knock your block and terror your town. Broken faces, burning beds, deal off some for the living dead. We are a corporation. We are a company. We are cut hard, and we're cutting hard anyway. We are your mother, father. We are your final friend. It never started, and it won't end. Tell me, what is that? What is happening here? We are your mother, father? That's genuinely disturbing. What does he even mean, though? The Andrew WK conspiracy theory site, What Happened to Andrew WK, claims that the song's lyrics make no attempt to veil WK's references to Babylon, September 11th, and that he himself is a corporation, a factory. I find this explanation a little nonsensical. I Love NYC could maybe be about a gang war, a military invasion, or a silent Tristero's empire from Thomas Pynchon's The Crying Lot of 49. But whatever is going on in those lyrics is a deranged, awful thing, and the fact that it is never clarified or defined makes it so much worse. The incongruous and inane happy chorus, Oh Yeah, New York City, makes it an unholy nightmare. I digress. I can't help these digressions, because with Andrew WK, I can never know what the author intended, or what I am inventing, or inviting, or imagining. I can't explain it, and I don't get it, but that's what happened. 2 years later, Island released WK's second album, The Wolf, which featured bizarre ingredients used to create I Get Wet, and they were meted out or to slightly different proportions, less ministry, more meatloaf. But the results were similarly misunderstood and slightly remarkable. Both albums are essential as far as I'm concerned. The abject violence had been dialed down, in its place was a message of survival and solidarity that somehow felt even more disquieting. Or did it? Here, too, I have to be conscious of erroneously inputting to the author a message that he never meant to send. I can say this much, at least. Fully aware that my reaction says more about me than it does Andrew W.K., I, for one, found The Wolf to be a disquieting experience, especially in light of I Get Wet. I didn't know what to make of lyrics like, all we ever wanted was a thing to believe, and now we've found it, and we have all we need. And here's another one. The conquest will survive, we have found our pride. Both are examples that are culled from a song called Long Live the Party. It's not quite as depraved as the party is described on I Get Wet, but it is an unusual usage of the word party, is it not? I'm not imagining that, am I? Nonetheless, it was a party, so WK stayed on brand, even as the brand morphed into an entirely different organism and a decidedly stranger thing. Make no mistake, this stuff precisely why I was personally so immediately obsessed with Andrew W.K. The deliberate misuses of language and inexplicable misinterpretations of evidence, the cognitive dissonance, the darkness, the dread, the disguises. Some of these things were hidden in plain sight, but W.K. scattered them like a breadcrumb trail leading ever deeper into a place where the possibility of plain sight was lost amid long shadows and tricks of light. Incidentally, I also appreciated and approved of the surface-level signals and signs flashed by WK, or the ones I recognized at least. His presentation slyly included a number of careful aesthetic choices that indicated to me the presence of a kindred spirit. Without even once decoding it for the uninitiated, WK was referencing the golden age of American death metal, when American death metal was weird and scary and dangerous. He hired Obituary's Donald Tardy to play drums for his band. He sliced open his face with an X-Acto knife for a photo shoot. He covered himself in pig's blood. He had long, greasy hair and gross facial growth favored by teenage dirtbags. He wore big, puffy 80s high tops. He moved to fucking Florida, for fuck's sake. Or at least he claimed to have moved to Florida. Again, who knows? But in any case, he knew what Florida meant. What Florida had been before it had come to the place that gave us Backstreet Boys and Limp Bizkit. Up close, you could see his customary all-white outfit, tight jeans, tight t-shirt, puffy 80s high tops, was smeared with nasty stains of unidentifiable origins. But from a distance, especially against a black backdrop, it looked as though he covered his entire body in corpse paint. The fun stuff was a front, a game. It was like a Skittles bag filled with crack, a caramel apple concealing a razor blade, a joint laced with PCP. Andrew W.K. was fucking with the dark shit, the evil shit, the cult shit. The funniest part was watching him do it, watching him get away with it, and waiting for someone to finally clock it. It had to happen. Needless to say, it didn't. From the beginning of 2002 through the end of 2004, Andrew W.K. was working nonstop, doing press for I Get Wet, touring for I Get Wet, recording The Wolf, and doing press for The Wolf, touring for The Wolf. Tardy estimates that they did 500 shows during that time span. He also had a series on MTV2 called Your Friend Andrew. Recorded a jingle for Kit Kat, and maintained a fairly active online presence. That kind of workload could cause anyone to crack, especially somebody who performs with the full throttle intensity of Andrew W.K. And as the Wolf tour wound down to its final dates, somebody cracked, and that's when things got weird. It's been too long now for me to pinpoint precisely how I was made aware of the developments that followed the Wolf. I remember only that I arrived at the scene earlier than most, many years earlier in fact, and was still late enough to feel fully disoriented by the stories I found myself reading upon arrival. By that point, the situation was already badly out of control, and catching up meant diving headfirst into the middle of a very deep, very dark lake, and from there swimming blindly to what I believed to be the perimeter. I never set foot on the lake's floor, I never got a clear feel for its shape or size. Even now, having spent months in pursuit of a number of hours that can only be described as irresponsible, I feel lost just thinking about it. Rather than reconstruct for you my own scattered experience then, I'm going to do my best to put together a concise timeline of the crucial events, or the events that are to my mind crucial. As a result, I'm leaving out a lot, including some of the strangest details. If I've excluded any truly valuable pieces of information, I have done so unintentionally, and I apologize. I encourage you to begin a search of your own if you're curious to learn more. But I must warn you, you will learn nothing so much as the boundaries of your own patience. You'll find fewer facts and more curiosity. Curiouser and curiouser. I won't say that it's not worth it, though. I also wouldn't dream of attempting to catalog the many, many oddities I've found in such searches. Instead, my hope here is to present to you a coherent account consisting of only facts. I want to underscore that last point because it's important for me to make this absolutely unequivocally clear. These are the facts. I'm not interested in perpetuating any mythology. I'm trying to find the long-buried seed of truth from which this dense, vast forest of confusion has grown. These are facts. These are actually legitimately what truly happened in real life, in real time, in front of real people. Believe what you want to believe, but this is not fiction. These are facts. These things happened. On the night of December 17th, 2004, in Elizabeth, New Jersey, Andrew W.K. had been scheduled to perform at the WSOU Holiday Bash, a charity event organized by Seton Hall's college radio station. The show went off as planned, except for the fact that WK's set was cut short. Immediately afterward, a bizarre rumor began making the rounds. The man on stage that night had not been the real Andrew W.K. He had the same clothes, a similar haircut and build, but he had a different face. He had been an imposter, or a replacement, or a stand-in, or something else, some sort of facsimile of Andrew W.K. The source of the rumor has never been identified, but 6 years later, the person who booked that show, then WSOU program director Dan Rodriguez, shared his account of the events in question. In brief, Rodriguez said that there was nothing suspicious about the event's abrupt conclusion. We were going to run past curfew. He also never questioned the identity of the artist on stage. He certainly looked like Andrew W.K. from where I was standing. However, per Rodriguez, the next few weeks were consumed by hundreds of callers that flooded WSOU's request lines and my direct business line each and every day. I spent way too many hours pleading with message board nutjobs and callers who insisted I was part of the conspiracy because I denied it. Anything short of an admission was considered a lie. On December 19th, 2004, 2 days after the gig in Elizabeth, a person named Christine Williams, identified as webmaster of Andrew W.K.'s official site, awkworld.com, participated in an online Q&A where she fielded a few similar queries, two of which I've included in this document without comment below. It would be impossible for me to summarize these exchanges for reasons that will become evident when you read them. For purposes of concision and clarity, however, I've liberally condensed and lightly copy edited them, excising some text and cleaning up the rest, with the exception of one minor error that I've chosen to let stand. William's copy was nearly pristine, which is especially impressive given its density, intricacy, and jarring tonal shifts. Question. Hey, a lot of people don't think that was Andrew W.K. at the NJ show. I am one of them. What's going on, Christine? To answer all of your questions, there has been a lot of confusion regarding this New Jersey concert. People have been especially curious about where Andrew went after the show and whether or not it was in fact Andrew himself on stage. Well, let me be the first one to tell you that you can take a deep breath and relax. Please calm down. It was a spectacular concert and everything went over very well and the night was a success. We should all feel great about this show. Many of you did mention some strange unexplained moments during the evening, mainly due to the stopping of the show early before the band could finish the intended set and how Andrew was moving. This was due to a small problem with people backstage. Everything was taken care of smoothly, and everyone made it out in one piece. At the end of the show, we moved at the same time as they worked with the equipment and finished it up perfectly. We just want people to know that it went over very well. At this point, all we can do is look at the information we've been collecting and continue with our research into the facts. We will not be responding to false accusations, nor will we be threatened by those who choose deception over fairness. I will never be disappointed with a good Andrew W.K. show.
What?
Yeah. Yo, Christine. Where the heck is Andrew? We don't want to hear from you. We want to hear from Mr. W.K. himself. Bring back Andrew W.K. I must admit, I feel slightly uneasy trying to explain to you where Andrew is. And let me also state for the record that I am in no way trying to fill in for Andrew. I am simply here to answer questions, one at a time, on a moment-by-moment basis. Tonight will be the last Andrew KW concert of 2004. We trust that the fans will come out in full force and raise the bar higher than ever. This is our last chance to build a night of never-ending excitement. Sold out in New Jersey. I wish I could be there. As Andrew himself has stated, he will always be there. You just might not see him. Assumptions are once again at the mercy of possibility. Standards are suddenly stripped and elevated. Precepts and formalities no longer conceal the limitless possibility that's always been there, and no longer will anticipated procedure shatter those expectations or limit the endless variations of outcome that can be experienced now. Things which have become familiar are now anomalous. Due to the current circumstances, we don't know who is causing this. We do have a very clear idea as to how to continue our research, but you must know that Andrew is not moving away, because he's already gone, which means he's actually closer to you than ever before. Remember, no sign is a good sign, and that still remains the case. The most important part of this will remain and flourish like never before. It's possible that your theories of comfort will be shattered in the ultimate liberation of understanding, but just when we feel we have no grasp, we'll realize that we've been holding on to the most solid structure the entire time. There's no reason for this to happen, except that it is. Except that it is. And enjoy yourself. As always, your pleasure remains the priority.
I don't even know what to say.
I know, right? This is where I was like, what?
Truly.
Like that, Andrew WK? This happened? That's a bunch of deeply inscrutable philosophy come hyperbole, obviously. And it neither teaches you nor tells you anything.
It reminds me of those, like, weird word salad bots.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me of Captain Coochie, doesn't it? So I encourage you to skim the above sentences for tone, rather than attempt to parse them for clarity. The same caveat applies to much of the block quoted text you'll find in this document, I'm afraid. However, Miss Williams does occasionally break through the bramble with some inspired wordplay. There is no reason for this to happen, except that it is. And then it says, except, like, E-X-C-E-P-T, except that it is. And then it says, accept that it is. Like, accept that it is. Back then, Andrew WK frequently used his web portals as a means to communicate with his audience. He had a website called AWK World, which no longer exists. And on that site, he had a Q&A page where visitors could submit questions to be answered by Andrew WK. The questions were often fairly generic, bored and or lonely fans looking for random advice or pep talks. And WK's answers were warm and encouraging and kind of often a bit platitudinous. Remember that this too shall pass. We need to enjoy what we've got because we won't have it forever, etc. Incidentally, these are great bits of advice used on Timeless Wisdom. The fact that they are platitudes doesn't make them any less true. At the end of 2004, though, the tone changed suddenly. The answers started making no sense. They weren't even answers. They were obscure declarations. This is how the formation begins. Soon after that, these declarations were typed out in numerical code. And it was literally like, it's just like, we love you. And I guess my question is, will you hang in there for yourself more than anybody or anything? Dear Linda, yes, this is already well underway. There is no going back now. I'm grateful for all love ever given. What's laid the foundation, which we're now to begin building. In this conclusion, we drive fast forward. And then there's a bunch of fucking weird numbers, all in parentheses. And it says Andrew WK.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the code was easily cracked. You can match each number to the corresponding letter in the alphabet, i.e. 1 equals A, 2 equals B, 3 equals C, and so on. Other codes were quite more complicated, and some were literally indecipherable, probably just nonsense. I'm not going to bother with any of that because it's pointless. The code itself was pointless, well, mostly pointless. There is one thing in the code that will help you navigate this maze. There is one thing you need to know. This is explained on the website awilkscrier.homestead.com. A simple message would read, all these numbers are in parentheses, so it's like 19, then 20, 5, then 5, 22-13, 9, 11, 5, which translates into Steve Mike, S-T-E-E-V, Mike. The two number 5s next to each other, 5, 5, was seen again and again in many different pieces of code. In point of fact, you absolutely don't need to even know all of that. Let me just rearrange the sentences a bit, because you do need to know this. The two number fives directly next to each other, 5-5, translates to Steve Mike. That's all you need to know. All you need to know is 5-5, 5-5, 5-5 equals Steve Mike, Steve Mike. On one day during the final 2 months of 2004, a message appeared on Andrew WK's website. I first read the message on December 21st, 2004, and it scared the hell out of me. In almost every single account published after the fact, this message reads slightly differently than when I first saw it. At some point, somebody revised it. They cleaned up many spelling errors and they changed some pronouns from the first person to the second person, and they removed the postscript altogether. The fact that someone took the time to make these changes is almost as disquieting as the message itself, in either form. The fact that no one seems to be aware of the original unedited version is inexplicable. But I have it, and I will share it with you now, unabridged, unaltered, exactly as it first appeared on Andrew WK's official site. Dear Andrew WK, to start, let me say that I respect you and our fans very much. You know how much I believe in you and all that you stand for, because I stood for it first. You know how much I love your music, because I created it. You know that I love the way you look and act and sing and dance, because it was born in my brain. Hopefully by now you've noticed that I've hacked into the websites. Maybe you haven't seen everything, but our fans have. In fact, your fans are well on their way to knowing the truth. I've been giving them bits and pieces, hoping that you'd come to your senses and stop trying to squeeze me out. Well, you haven't responded to my initial requests, and now you're forcing me to make threats. When you act unprofessional, so will I. Now I have no choice but to let the facts speak for themselves. I never wanted it to come to this, but I can no longer wait in the background and ignore your complete disrespect. You've exploited the automatic disadvantage our agreement puts me in. My choice to let you enjoy the spotlight while I create the magic leaves me almost helpless. I'm going to extreme, but it's spelled X-T-R-E-E-M, mm-hmm. measures. But you will not get me to expose myself until I expose you first. I know that the quick rise of fame has clouded your memory concerning our partnership. I was willing to forgive you and ignorant choices because you're a young star. However, your recent efforts to exclude me from the third album will not be tolerated. I will not work for the last year on these songs just to have you break your promises and my heart. Our fans deserve to know the truth. Our fans are smart. That's why I've put together the same letter you're holding now on one of the many websites I've created through our company. By the time you read this, our fans will have read it too. Don't worry. I've made it hard for all of but the most dedicated fans to read. But know this. More and more people will find out the real story, unless you stop trying to sabotage our contract. I've chosen not to let the press, to go to the press with this, yet I still value our relationship and I want to continue with all that we initially planned. But if you refuse to comply, I will have no choice but to reveal myself and reveal you as a backstabbing fraud. It's your choice, yours truly, Steve Mike. P.S. Unless you want even more people to find out the truth about the music, our agreement, and your new girlfriend, stop with your plans and hold up your end of the deal. I think I will stop there. Ugh. And I will do a part two next week.
Ugh.
At first it's long, right? And you're just like, why are we talking about this? Because it's just a music review.
Well, so I'm somewhat aware of him as a, like, mysterious figure in that, like, I've seen YouTubers cover his appearance
mm-hmm.
before, but I've literally never heard any of this other stuff before.
Yeah.
And this is, like, a rabbit hole I did not know existed.
Yeah, I knew it existed at the time, but I didn't know how deep it went until I read this article. So I think that the reason why I decided to read it instead of, like, writing my own coverage on this is I think that this writer is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I love his personality and the way that he covers it all. And also, he's done a ton of research, and I want people to know about this article.
Yeah, for sure.
But, yeah, I'm a huge fan of Andrew WK, but I didn't know all of these little, like, subplots that go on. And it gets, like, honestly weirder as we go forward.
I'm excited for the weirdness.
So sorry it took so long to get into, but it will be worth it.
Well, it's all necessary background.
Right. Especially if you don't know who he is, which we talked about trying, like, not to cover stuff, assuming you guys know who this person is. Right. So,
I mean, if I'm honest, I am mostly associated with that one song, the
Party Hard.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
And that's because I think it was on, like, a Madden 2008 soundtrack that my brother had on, like, the GameCube.
Yep.
Or something. Maybe, if it had to have been older than 2008, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. I actually went to go see him in concert right before quarantine happened, and it was great. And he started following me on Twitter, so humble brag.
Yeah. This is our first cliffhanger, too.
I know. I thought, yeah. I just can't read this whole article at once, so
I think next week. It's nice to have a cliffhanger every once in a while. I think this is kind of exciting.
Yeah. So you will find out more about the mystery of Andrew W.K. and who is Steve Mike.
I don't know. So I assume that most of you guys enjoy a good story, a good reading experience, or a good listening experience. We are lucky enough to get to have a code with Audible that will allow you to get a free audiobook and a free, I believe,
two Audible originals. Ooh, and there's actually some good stuff on there.
Yeah, we talked a couple episodes ago about how I think the Sandman audiobook is up right now, which I still have not listened to, but I really, really want to.
It's a full audio production, like, with a full cast. It's like a radio show type thing, and I'm definitely going to listen to it when I start school.
Yeah. And plus, even if you don't get into the originals, there's, like, a huge library of titles that are available on Audible. And even if you don't keep your subscription up, you get to keep the book, which is incredible. Like, I cannot imagine turning down a free book. So if this is something that sounds interesting to you, if this sounds right up your alley, if you're looking for something else to listen to once this episode runs out and you're like, I need more, you should definitely go over to audibletrial.com/, what is it, XIII Club?
13 Club, yeah, XIII Club.
XIII Club, 13 Club.
And we'll link it for you on the website if you forget.
Yes, we have a little section on our website that has links to both of our incredible partners. So,
which is 13club.com.
Yes.
XIII club.com.
So yeah, I highly, highly recommend that you head on over and find something new. And if you do, let us know what you're reading, because I want to know what you're reading.
And then, you know, if you like coffee, we got the coffee hookup for you.
The coffee hookup.
Yeah, we are a partner with Grinding Coffee Company. They are an excellent charitable organization that they cater to LGBT and other marginalized creators. They are Black owned, and they are really ethical with the ways that they source their coffee. Also, the coffee is delicious. So if you head on over to grindingcoffee.co, you can get 13% off with our code THE13CLUB. That's THEXIII CLUB.
These really great sampler packs, which are amazing if you're someone like me who cannot make a decision and you always like to try new stuff. I did a sampler pack of their, like, origin coffees. And as someone who, like, tends towards more, like, flavor-oriented stuff and is not so good at picking out, oh, well, this definitely came from Brazil and this came from Ethiopia. Like, this speaks to the quality of their, like, brew or whatever, that, like, I could take, like, there was a distinctly different taste for everything, and I could identify, like, different flavor palettes and things like that. And I'm actually like, kind of into, like, I'm like, ooh, I think maybe I'm really into, like,
ooh, I might be a coffee,
like,
girl.
I might like Brazilian stuff, like, blends specifically. And I have because I am so ready to live my best autumnal life. I recently ordered a bag of the pumpkin spice, and I cannot wait to tell you guys about it.
Yeah, I really want to know, because I will probably order it if you like it. All right, guys, we will be back next week. Actually, next week you'll get a postmortem, and then after that, you'll get part two of the Andrew W.K. story.
I am already on the edge of my seat. I'm going to be sitting on this edge for 2 weeks. It would mean so much to us if you guys would take the time to leave us a rating and a review, especially on iTunes, but really wherever you listen to us. It helps other people find us. It helps get the word out there. Our little club can grow. It just, you know, it makes us really happy to get the kind of feedback from you guys. You can always reach us with questions, comments, concerns, requests, or you can write in your own spooky story to our website. The email is up there. It's ask13club@gmail.com, or you can reach us on our social media, which is also on the website.
Everything is on the website if you ever forget. We will talk to you next week, guys. Have a spooky one.
Bye.